right. And so what I'd like to do this morning is we're in part three of a four-part message. Next Sunday, Noah's going to close this short series out of the Gospel of Matthew about the birth of Christ. And then, of course, next Monday night, I'll be here for Christmas Eve services. So we're going to double down on you next week. We're going to take note of who comes on Sunday and who only comes on Monday. And we will forward that information to people that have great power over your life. All right. If you would join me, I'm going to put it on the screen here behind you. I'm going to read from Matthew chapter 2, 1 through 12. And let me just say this as we read this. A very familiar story to anybody that's heard the birth story of Christ. But read it with new eyes this morning and ask yourself questions like, whoa. And maybe I'll throw some of those questions at you as I'm reading it. But it's about the Magi. So read with me here. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." That should just set off all kinds of questions in your mind, right? Who are these guys? How do they know he's King of the Jews? How did they attach a star to him being the King of the Jews? And who are these cats that are going to come and worship him, right? When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. Verse 4. When he had called together Herod, all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. So, what do we know here? He's aware of a coming Messiah too, right? They say to him, verse 5, in Bethlehem in Judea, for this is what the prophet has written. Micah, by the way, you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." Liar, liar, pants on fire. Verse 9. After they heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. A star. Verse 10, when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And 12, and having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. And we drop down to verse 16. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi when they first saw that star. This is the word of the Lord. Now, this is a passage, again, out of Matthew, about the birth of Christ that we're looking at in December. Luke and Matthew record the birth of Jesus, both of them with very distinct flavor in what they report. What we've looked at so far in Matthew is we looked at the genealogy, and then last week we looked at how Joseph got on board because he knew he didn't impregnate Mary. Now, any of you here this morning that know the Christmas carol, "We Three Kings of Orient Are," may be in for a little surprise today because, as you can see in the passage here, there are no kings. But it does say Magi, from which we get the words magician, magistrate. But we'll get to that in a second. There aren't three of them, but there are three gifts, okay? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, I'm going to give my wife, she's not here, so I can say this, three gifts for Christmas. But that doesn't mean there are three of me. Oh, she is here! Well, baby, I got you three. I don't know what you got me. Okay. And I want you to notice that Jesus, stick with me on this one, is in a house. Did you catch that? They came to Jesus in a house by the time they get there. In fact, it's right, I'll repeat that for you right there. On coming to the house, the Magi saw the child with his mother. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just stay with me here for a second. There is a lot of speculation, and nobody knows for sure. I'm just going to tell you that. That's what I'm going to be black and white about. Nobody knows for sure. When did the Magi come? Some will say it was up to 2 years after Christ was born. When you couple the two stories of Luke and Matthew together, it leaves some big question marks of the timing of all this stuff. Let me just say something that might lend itself to the side of the story that says they were actually there very close to his birth and not when he was a toddler, okay? And it's the story, really, of the manger versus the house. Let me tell you something about the culture at that time. It would be unthinkable in Jewish culture of that day for Joseph to return to the place of his heritage, of his namesake, King David, his ancestral origins, if you will, and not to have been received by people in that community. It was a highly hospitable culture. And even if they weren't close relatives, as soon as he said, I am of the line of David, you know, and even if he hadn't been traveling to go to the place where his heritage was, he still would have been greeted and welcomed by people. So, what are we saying about this verse in Luke? Not in Matthew, but in Luke, where it says, and Mary brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger. We all know the story, right? Because there was no room for them in the inn. We have heard that our entire lives, right? In fact, Robin used that as the theme of her talk on Friday night with the women. There's no room for him at the inn. Will you make room for him in your heart, right? Well, let me show you the NIV version today of that very passage and how they translate that verse now. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths, placed him in a manger, because there was no guest room available for them. Follow this. The Greek word for that's translated guest room here, or in the other passage, is the word kataluma, and it means either in, like a commercial place, or a spare or upper room in a private house where you received hospitality when you went there. There's a picture of a two-story classic first century Jewish home. The downstairs, as you can see, is a living area with the kitchen, one room, and adjacent to that is where their animals were sheltered. Animals came in. It was a barn house. The animals came right in and stayed there at night. That's how you protected them from the cold, protected them from being taken or whatever. And that area where the animals stayed, we would call a stall, is also known as a manger. John did a message on this 5 years ago on December 8th. He covers it in much more detail than I'm going to cover for you right now. And here's another illustration of that area. And if you notice in this drawing illustration where you see the two little circles, those are called mangers or the feeding troughs. But the whole area there in the back left is known as the stable. And the mangers would actually be the place where they would literally could have holes cut out between the stable area and the living area where the animals would stick their head through and eat in those troughs. Okay? That is what that means. In the Christmas story, I'm about ready to have people throw fruit at me, rotten fruit. It's very plausible that Jesus is not in some distant stable. Rather, he is very likely in the midst of distant relatives and other visiting relations due to the census, and there was a crowd that arrived ahead of him. Certainly, he's traveling with a pregnant wife. And because the house is literally packed with people coming to this little village because they're the line of David for the census, they set up shop in the stable area of that home. Jesus actually says as much about that area to the Pharisees later on in his public ministry, some 30 years after his birth. In Luke 13, it's recorded, he's talking to the Pharisees who are busting his chops because he's done something on the Sabbath, right? That happened all the time. And he says to these guys, he goes, "You hypocrites, doesn't each of you on the Sabbath untie your ox or donkey from the manger and lead them out to give it water?" He's talking, he goes, "You're taking your own animals out to get them water on the Sabbath." So I want to tell you, I think Jesus was born in the company of distant relatives. Again, John, December 8th, 2013, go back and listen to the message. In the manger part of the home. Helping us to explain maybe why the Magi say, on coming to the house, they saw the child. So there you have it. Luke goes on to tell us in Luke 2:39 that eventually they end up in Nazareth. And Matthew 2:23 says eventually they went to Nazareth after a 2-year hiatus to Egypt to escape Herod and the killing of the boys. Now, I know some of you are thinking, what are you going to tell us next? There's no Santa? Yes, I will. And that's my Christmas Eve sermon. Okay. All right, that was my little digression in the message this morning. Let's quickly, and it will be quickly, look at the wise man's story since it's Christmas and it's in here. When you look at the story of the wise man, it doesn't fit with the rest of the scene. Right? It doesn't. It's only in Matthew. Where do these guys come from? Well, one thing we know from history about these guys is they weren't kings at all. They were priests, certainly in the first century, of Zoroaster, or Zoroasterism, still alive and well today. They were Medo-Persians, right? Where Iran and Iraq are today. Zoroasterism is a monotheistic faith, a one-god faith that started in 6th century B.C. The god's name was Ahura Mazda, just like the car. And if you remember your Bible from Daniel, Darius the Great, when they overthrew Babylon, was the king, the Medo-Persian king, and he established that faith, the Zoroasterism, as their national religion. So it's an ancient faith of 6th century B.C. Now, these Zoroasterism priests, what did they do? The Magi were scientists. They were the mathematicians of their country. They were very powerful politically. They were known all throughout the Near East. So how did these powerful scientist priests, the question I asked when I first read the verse, hear about a baby in Bethlehem? And they say it's just a celestial event of some sort. It is the most improbable sounding story in the scriptures. Until you remember, in the Old Testament is the book of Daniel, who is, in fact, a prophet. But he's much more than just a prophet. And the book of Daniel is an amazing storyline of Jewish elite young men being taken up during the overthrow of Babylon over Jerusalem. They ultimately destroyed it in 539 B.C. And they brought them up to Babylon. And they took these young men and they raised them in the Babylonian court. Well, and when you know about Daniel, and part of his story, he was a dream interpreter for the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar has this very disturbing dream. And all of his magi are brought to him, and none of them can interpret the dream. And then they go get Daniel. And Daniel interprets the dream because God gives it to him. And so Nebuchadnezzar is going to kill all of the magi because they couldn't give him his dream. Daniel gives him his dream. He believes what he hears from Daniel. It makes sense. And then Daniel pleads for the lives of the Magi. And he's successful. And he saves their lives. Later on in the story, when Daniel is put in the lion's den, it is not the Magi that put him there. It was the government officials who did that. The Magi were on board with Daniel. And we are told in Daniel chapter 2 that when King Nebuchadnezzar, after he interpreted his dream, Daniel was placed in the high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all of its wise men, or as I put there, magi. Daniel, in 6th century B.C., was the chief magi. And you're thinking to yourself, so what? Well, here's what. they more than likely possessed a copy of Daniel's prophecies that he later wrote in chapter 9 of his book of the Bible. And let me show you these prophecies. Daniel in chapter 9 says, "While I was still in prayer," and boy, was he a prayer warrior, "Gabriel, the man I had seen in an earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice." He's talking about an angel who appears to look like a man whose name is Gabriel. And so in this vision, Gabriel announces to Daniel, and here's where it gets tricky, "A period of 70 sets of seven has been decreed for your people and your holy city, Jerusalem, to finish their rebellion and to put an end to their sin, to atone for their guilt, to bring an everlasting righteousness, to confirm the prophetic vision, and to anoint the most holy place." Verse 25, "Now listen and understand." Seven sets of seven plus 62 sets of seven will pass from the time the command is given to rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One comes. The one who is going to do what? Finish their rebellion, put an end to their sin, atone for their guilt, to bring an everlasting righteousness, to confirm this prophetic vision. According to this prophecy from Daniel's book, from the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, there'd be the seven seven-year periods and 62 seven-year periods. Ultimately, seven times seven, it's 7 years blocks. It totals 483 years between those two predictions. Until what? Until the Messiah would show up. In 6th century B.C., Daniel is given the vision of when God's holy anointed Christ would come in triumph to the world. Pretty specific prophecy here, isn't it? Now, both the ancient Hebrews to whom Daniel was writing and the ancient Babylonians to whom he was subservient, because the book of Daniel was written in Babylon, in those days they used the Hebrew lunar calendar of 360 days a year. So the whiz-bangs of today, the mathematicians, these guys that can do this stuff, look at 483 years and they multiply it by 360. And they come up with this figure of 173,880 days is what the prophecy is talking about. And he goes, we can calculate those days to know when the Anointed One comes, right? So what they do is they take the Gregorian calendar, our modern calendar, with the 365-day years, and they adjust that, right, to what it would be. And it would be 476 years and 25 days, right? Now they got to find a starting point for this whole thing, right? Well, when was the order given? Well, interestingly enough, in the Old Testament is the book of Nehemiah. And the Persian emperor at the time of Nehemiah is Artaxerxes. By the way, we just did the book of Esther recently. Artaxerxes was a generation removed from the king that Esther was married to. So pretty close in proximity, right? And he was the cupbearer to the king, and he ruled Artaxerxes from like 464 to 424 BC. He is the king that issued the edict to rebuild Jerusalem. And we're told exactly what Hebrew month and exactly what year of his reign. It is in Nehemiah chapter 1 and chapter 2. I, Nehemiah, was cupbearer to the king. Man, I know I'm throwing a lot of names and a lot of things out at you here at once, and I know it gets confusing. So you're just going to have to come back and listen to me three times today to get all this. In the month of Nisan, that's a Hebrew month, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I, the cupbearer, has to drink and make sure it's not poisoned, I took the wine and gave it to the king. Right? So he gives you a very specific date. He says, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah, Jerusalem, where my ancestors are buried, so that I can rebuild it. It specifically says that. So I can rebuild it. And it says in verse 6, the next verse, it pleased the king to send me. Now we know from history that Artaxerxes, on March 14th, they know this from calculating these dates, 445 B.C., issued the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. Okay? Remember that 170,888 days. Okay, so now they got a starting point, and then they take those days and adjusting for leap years. And I have no idea why that is doing that. I apologize to you. Something went goofy on the computer up there. Adjusting for leap years, they drop a leap year every 128 years. They calculated that the day of the prophecy would be fulfilled would correspond to a converted date in our calendar today from Hebrew to the Gregorian calendar of April 6, 32 A.D. Isn't that fascinating? That's when the Messiah would ride triumphantly into Jerusalem upon a donkey. It seems absolutely implausible, does it not? For something to be this specific for such a long shot, over five centuries old. But let me show you more. The New Testament records that Jesus' public ministry began in Luke chapter 3:1 in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. We know that Tiberius' reign after Caesar Augustus began in 14 A.D. So 15 years, 14 A.D., that puts you at 29 A.D. when you add those together. Then you add in 3 years that Jesus ministered publicly. If he began in the 15th year, he has 3 years of public ministry before he dies. That bumps you to 32 A.D. Now it gets real spooky. We call it Palm Sunday, right? When Christ rides triumphantly into Jerusalem. The Royal Observatory in Greenwich, England. They are, even to this day, the keepers of the clock. They confirm that if you go back to 32 AD and match it with the Hebrew calendar on what day would Passover have been, right? You guessed it, when he would be riding in. April 6, 32 A.D. So the Magi, remember again, this is just this obscure story that pops up in Matthew that's nowhere else. Who are these cats? 450 years, you add 33 to that's 483 years. Remember, that's what the original prediction was. So 450 years after Daniel wrote the prophecy, these Magi are waiting for the birth of this coming king. And they were stargazers. That was part of their gig, was astrologers. How did we know that the star they were seeing was announcing his birth? We don't. They don't say. All we know is they had Daniel's prophecies because he was formerly their chief Magi five centuries early. The world was anticipating the coming of the Messiah. I honestly believe it had everything to do with Daniel's prophecy. But these guys, above all people, were dialed into this thing. It was very specific, and they were looking for it. So when you read Matthew's account, which we did this morning, Jesus was born in the town of Bethlehem during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some wise men from the Eastern lands arrived, asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews? We have seen his star." They were looking for him, in my estimation, because of this passage in Daniel. 69 sets of seven will pass from the time the command is given to rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one comes. By the way, there were 70 weeks of Daniel, but only 69 till the anointed one comes. Where's the 70th week? It's a seven-year period. Seems there's something in the book of Revelation about another seven-year period that has remained to be fulfilled, depending on your end times theology. I'm just trying to convey to you guys, you know, when people look at Christianity and they look at our faith and they just say, "Oh, you people believe in a bunch of hooey." Oh, really? This is amazing statistics, this prophecy. It gives teeth to the truth. And this is so interesting. This five-century-old prophecy does not say what? Where the Messiah will be born. It just says he's coming, right? Where do these guys go? Jerusalem. Why do they go to Jerusalem? Because they know it's the capital of the Jewish people. Where else would you go to pay homage to their coming king? And that's why it says right there in the very beginning of the story, They come from the east and they ask, where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? They are surprised that no one in Jerusalem knows of this event. And here's the thing about these guys. They probably arrived with a small army. It's said that these magi would travel in large caravans of over 200. And they would not be riding camels, by the way. They would travel on horses. We call them today Arabian horses. They intimidated the entire city of Jerusalem with their arrival. It wasn't just three little guys scooting in on camels, right? That's why it says in verse 3, he records, Herod heard this and was disturbed, as all Jerusalem with him. You see, I can just miss something in a passage. Do you know how much meat's in that phrase right there? They were rocked, man. What are these guys talking about? Right? So here's the question we want to get to. Now you know why these guys showed up, because I think of Daniel's prophecy, but why would Matthew record this in his gospel? You know, Luke records the shepherds, right? But Matthew talks about these wise guys. Why? Well, these powerful Near East kingmakers from Persia travel this great distance to honor a king in whose coronation they played no part whatsoever. They just understood this is the one. That's why it says when he had called them together, Herod had called his chief priests and scribes together, and he's learned from the prophet Micah that it's in Bethlehem that this king was to be born. I think there's something really funny in a weird sort of way about these magi, these wise men, these political elites of their day, these scholar mathematicians, or the intelligentsia, so to speak. And what happens? They're being led to the deep, backwater, nowhereville town of Bethlehem. It would be like if any of you have ever made the trip to Vegas on Highway 95 via Yerington and you go south and you hit Shears, Nevada, right? Out there in the middle of nowhere, just east of Walker Lake before you come down into Hawthorne, right? There is nothing in Shears. It could be Bethlehem. And that's where these powerful elite guys are told to go. And I think Matthew is showing us a very clear picture that God's wisdom is not the world's wisdom. He's got the biggest, the best, and the brightest dudes on the planet. And he's sending them in wisdom to show them something that they wouldn't otherwise understand because they're used to the high court and the pomp and circumstance. Because the wisdom of this world says if you're really going to make a difference in this life, you have to go to the right schools, you have to have the right skills, you got to have the right people in your pocket. And we know this, that Jesus wasn't born into the right family. He certainly wasn't born in the right place, as the world would see. He did not have the right credentials. He never wrote a book. He didn't lead an army. He didn't do anything the world's way. He always did everything his Father's way. And what is his Father's way? Well, he tells us the way up is down. The way to get power is to serve. The way to get really rich in life, which is to actually gain this love that you can never lose, is to give all your money away. And that is the absolute opposite of what the world says. That wisdom of the world tends to superficiality. And I'll tell you, part of preaching here on Sunday is all about what? Unplugging that world mindset from us by teaching us God's way through Christ, right? So here's the application. If you look at your own success in life and your material comfort, your money, your power, maybe your looks, and you do what most of us do based on worldly wisdom is we take an inventory of ourselves in that picture, as it were. And you like to feel either good or bad about your inventory, right? that this is what this story is saying, because the most powerful elite guys go to Bethlehem to bend their knees to a baby. Stop that. Stop looking at yourself in those terms and comparing yourself. God looks to the heart, to the inside, not the outside. Those things, he says, your poverty is not important. Your riches certainly aren't important. And God has shown the wisdom of the world to be foolishness by the very birth of Christ. You know that Isaiah wrote this 7 centuries B.C.? I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, God says. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. What's Isaiah predicting? God's way is not this world's way, is it? Paul picks up on this because he actually quotes that passage in 1 Corinthians when he writes centuries later. And he says, where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him. Except these magi. Paul's saying, where are all the smart people that have all the answers? How much closer to peace is man than he was a century ago or a millennium ago? How much closer are we to eliminating poverty, hunger, ignorance, crime, immorality than we were in Paul's day? You know, for all our advances in technology and communication, we have not really advanced in the things that matter in our life. John MacArthur, author, pastor, Southern California, brilliant guy. I have his commentary series. Writes this. He says, we are more educated than our forefathers, but we are not more moral. We have more means to help one another, but we are not less selfish. We have not changed except in finding more ways to express and excuse our human nature. Throughout history, human wisdom has never basically It dropped off my last line. Let me find it for you and I'll read it to you. Changed and has never solved the problems of mankind. Human wisdom sees the immediate cause, but it does not see the root, John writes, which is always sin. How true is that, right? We see the immediate cause, right? And he goes on to say, in our culture, we may see the selfishness that causes injustice, but it has no way to remove the unselfishness. We may see the hatred that causes misery and pain, but we have no cure for the hatred. It sees plainly that we do not get along with one another, but it does not see that the real cause is man does not get along with God. And I'm sorry, the quote's cut off again. As long as it looks on God's wisdom as foolishness, its own wisdom will be foolishness. I think today, when you look in the news, and what do you see? You see this rivalry going on between competing philosophies, you know, of conservatives and liberalism, and everybody picks a side, and everybody spins their truth to fit their political motives and their political side. And the Me Too movement does what? It shames anyone, and shame they should be for this behavior, right? But does anybody talk about lust? No. Does anybody talk about the root of sin in the heart of man that makes him lust? No. All we do in culture and all this alleged wisdom we have is shame people. And you got to get your behavior like our behavior. And if you get your behavior like our behavior, we'll all be good. And you know what God calls that? Foolishness. He says, because you're not dealing with the root issue which is inside of you. Jesus was born in a manger to a poor unwed mother. And he was attended to, by, in the story of Luke, by shepherds who were as far on the outside as you could be in that culture. He was born in the wrong place to the wrong people. But according to Matthew, the smart guys of that day realized it for once. And that's why Matthew said, they went their way. And they found the child. And when they saw that star again, illuminating their way to where the child was, I believe personally, it wasn't a celestial event. It's too specific of a pinpointing to find a house. I believe it was the Shekinah glory of God appeared. just like it appears all throughout Scripture, and showed them the way to where the babe was. J.C. Ryle, he's this 19th century Christian Anglican bishop of Liverpool, so he would have been the Beatles' grandfather. He said, they heard no wise words out of his mouth. They saw nothing but a newborn infant on the lap of a poor woman, but they worshipped. No greater faith than this can be found in the whole volume of the Bible. Isn't that an interesting perspective of that visit? And the only reason these pagan wise men would worship is if by some divine revelation, they understood this is what we've been looking for all our lives. Let me suggest to you that you can have that same experience as these wise men. You can see in Jesus Christ the ultimate wisdom of God. You know, when Paul says to you and I that we can have that kind of experience in that passage where he says, where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? And then just three verses later, he immediately says, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews who wanted to count on the law of Moses and works righteousness, and complete foolishness to Gentiles, non-Jewish people. Because what? Somebody died for my sins? What? But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Think with me for a minute. What is God's wisdom? Is God so righteous and holy that he has to punish sin? Or is he so loving and merciful that he's going to accept you no matter what? The answer is both. And here's where these two concepts collide on the cross of Christ. God, in his supreme wisdom, does something that on one hand completely fulfills holiness and fulfills the requirements of the law, satisfies God's justice against all sin. Think about that. God is doing something to punish sin. And at the same time, he completely satisfies love and mercy by substituting his perfect Son in our place. He says, this is far more adequate than you dying for your sin, because the one who has not sinned becomes sin for you. That is the wisdom of God. Think of that. I'm fond of saying up here, God had to die for sin to be dealt with, but God was glad to die. Does that blow your socks off? You know, I know Robin spoke a lot about hope on Sunday night. All the hope in the world is tied up in those two little phrases I just said. God had to die, but he was glad to die. That is your hope. The Apostle Peter said, always be prepared to give an account of the hope that lies within you. He didn't tell us to have our doctrine dialed down and give them our doctrinal statement. He says, tell them about your hope. As a community, we have suffered great loss in the last few weeks. Young 18-year-old man dies tragically in a car accident. We lose a beloved physician in the most tragic of circumstances this week, plus all the people we've been losing here at Sierra over the last couple of months. And I say to you today, as we celebrate Christmas, what is the answer to these stories? There is only one answer. It is the hope that we have that Christ loved us enough to die in our place, and in doing so promises that we will live forever. What did he say to Mary and Martha when their brother Lazarus had died, before he brings him out of the grave after being dead for 4 days? He says, whoever believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? That is our great hope. Let's pray. Father, thank you for showing us the beauty of your wisdom, the way these wise men came to see that all wisdom was in you. And you know what's amazing is they couldn't see what we see. We have so much more information than they had. And we're so grateful you have shown us so much. I pray you help us to walk like your Son in all wisdom in this world. But we can only do that as we look more at Him and fall in love with Him for what He did for us on the cross. And in doing so, find ourselves transformed by that love more and more into His likeness. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.